This is Witchcraft Off the Beaten Path. I'm Molly Dyer. The date of today's podcast is April 14th, 2021. Wherever in the world you are, I hope you're enjoying this glorious Aries season. This is my time of year, so we Aries are the first sign of the zodiac, and we never let you non-Aries people forget about it. Humility is not an Aries strong suit, but neither is subtlety. I had a great birthday last week, and thanks to all of you who wished me a happy birthday. It was fantastic. And also, in case it's not flooding your social media at this very moment in the wake of the Derek Chauvin trial, Black Lives Matter. Still, honor the memory of George Floyd and fuck Derek Chauvin. The topic of today's episode is religious discrimination and persecution. And my guest is Maven Eller Five, whom you've heard from before on this podcast. Maven has been active in the witchcraft and pagan community for decades, much of which was right here in the Lone Star State in Texas. She's a civil rights activist and has worked tirelessly towards the protection of pagans and witches from oppression and discrimination, both in the Dallas-Fort Worth and the greater Houston pagan communities, not to mention her work with the West Memphis Three. She's been a leader of many organizations, and more importantly, she's been a fearless leader when it mattered the most. Maven is a seer in the truest form of the word. She is clairvoyant. She's a psychic. She's led rituals for up to around 1,000 people at once. I think that's the low end of the number, if I'm not mistaken. I'm probably mistaken. That's a pretty conservative estimate, I think, on my part. Maven Eller Five is the matriarch of the House of Five, a spiritual family, and that's family with a PH instead of an F, meaning family of choice. She's the steward of the U.S. chapter of the Hellfire Club, an international esoteric think tank of individualists, and a social club of like-minded people. She's been involved in a number of other organizations as well, some of them right from the ground up. But we're going to save a lot of those conversations for another podcast. This is not going to be the last time I have her on. It's not the first time either. She's a Leo sun and a whole bunch of Virgo, and those are her words also. Along with all these other things, Maven is my very, very dear friend. Like I said the last time she was a guest on my podcast, we've known each other for hundreds of years, she and I. She's the kind of friend who calls me out of the blue and says, "All right, you just came in loud and clear. What's wrong?" Maven once told me her greatest calling in this life was to be a mother to her children, and also a mother to anyone that needed mothering. And sometimes that's the whole damn pagan community. Please welcome my guest and my friend, Maven Eller Five. Hi, Maven.
Hi, Molly. How are you today?
I'm fantastic. When I got on the Zoom call with you to record, my day got better. So thank you so much for joining me again. And I hope you're well, and I hope that your people are well, and your bird, and everything in your life is going well. I try to stay in contact with you so I know what's going on.
But,
so,
you know, I have to take this moment to wish you a very happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Important to do so. I also wanted to tell you that I just realized within the moment just now as you were introducing me that the last time we saw each other was a whole lot of years ago this week.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're right. It was. Oh, that would have been at a Beltane festival.
It would have been at a Beltane. We would have been, and we were in the beautiful sunlight.
We were. And that was probably about, I'm going to say, what, 6 or 7 years ago? I don't remember now, but it's been a while. But it's kind of like we're one of those couple of people that pick up the phone and pick up right where we left off. And
always.
And like I said, also, you always know. I don't have to tell you if I need some Maven, you just know, and my phone rings.
So can I talk about that for a second?
Yes.
So, you know, I do this to people all the time, to the point it scares them. Like, people are like, if you're calling, I think you're reading my mind.
Right.
And the other night, it was like 10 p.m. here, and I wrote my daughter, and I said, "Hey, thinking about you." And she said, "I love you." And then a few seconds later, she goes, "Did you know I was talking about you?"
Maybe not consciously, but yeah, you knew.
I said, "Well, I pinged you. I didn't want to give away, you know, that, you know, I just had a feeling." But
right. Well, so listen, the topic of today's episode was actually, this was your idea. And I'm so glad, because it's one of those that's been on the long list of, you know, podcast topics that you cross through whenever cover one. But today's episode about religious discrimination, I have been very, very fortunate in my life to not have actually encountered much, actually, if any, religious persecution or discrimination. And if I mean, the things that I have encountered have been, I didn't lose my job. I never lost a relationship. I didn't, you know what I mean? They've been pretty insignificant. It's been mostly like the occasional very mild bullying, but that's about it. And I've been pretty quiet about my path, and mostly have remained in the broom closet for things like, you know, like I said, my mundane job or some casual acquaintances and people that I'm not very close to, or that I don't necessarily want to let into my life. Even this podcast, Witchcraft Off the Beaten Path with Molly Dyer. Molly Dyer is my pseudonym. And if you know, I've never made a secret of Molly Dyer not actually being my real name. If you know me, then you know what my name is, and that's fine. But that's my business, and I'm very careful with whom I share, you know, that legal name and that side of my life. And you, Maven, you live your life as an out pagan witch, and you absolutely embrace all of those titles that are given to you: high priestess and witch, pagan, community organizer, those sort of things. So let's talk about discrimination. That's what I know, that's what you want to talk about, and I am really, really interested to hear some of your stories about being discriminated against or persecuted from being a witch.
Well, and I'm a witch walking around with a blue moon tattooed in the middle of my forehead, so there are moments I've thought about that, you know, like traveling the back roads of Louisiana. There's been places that there's been moments about that. Right. But, you know, the reason I want to talk about this today is because of the work I do. You know, you've mentioned I'm a reader, but I still write and still mm-hmm. have contact with people in the community quite a bit. And there's a whole new batch of babies, what we used to call newbies, coming into this faith. And they're coming into it without what seems to be a great deal of knowledge. I'm not trying to insult anyone. I know several people who do really study. But I think it's important that we don't forget about the burning times. And when we talk about religious discrimination and persecution, we have to go back to the time of the burning times that we might remember why that's important. That in and of itself is a lot. You hear that associated to the Inquisition, and that happened during the dark times when the native European people, as had their own faith, much like you would first peoples here. And as Christianity moved into Europe, it kind of became a hostile takeover. I'm, you know, not picking sides here. I'm just sharing the truth.
Sure.
There is a saying that's come up from that. It's called Never Again the Burning Times, because in that time during religious persecution, and this was both men and women, I want to make sure people know that if you were found to be outside of the beliefs of the church, you were generally burned for that, or a variety of different torturous ways people were killed. Some people were put under doors and stones placed on top of that. People were stoned. People were drowned. And it depended upon what countries and where you come from. We know that even just preparing for this today, I was kind of going over my notes. And in the northern Scandinavia areas, there were more men killed than women for witchcraft in that time. But so part of what I felt the need to talk about was that we are certainly in a changing world all the time, and we still hear of other countries where, you know, there is still like Ghana, I think I said that right, and other countries that are still persecuting elderly women, taking their land for them and killing them for being witches. So while we might not see it here in the United States, what we witness here is more of being shunned from getting good jobs, being treated different in your families,
right?
Being pushed out of everyday, you know, social norms. You might not be picked for the fun PTA group. You might not be included in things in your neighborhood, all for being different. Though I think that has gotten better, but I do want to talk about the ways this used to be.
Okay.
Well, so one of the things I want to talk about is my place in community started in the mid-90s. I had all I can call is a flash in a flame that I was supposed to, and I didn't live in Dallas, I lived out in the country in Texas, that I was supposed to go to Dallas and start a community center to help stop discrimination. Not ever been anything I'd ever been called to, but I could not escape the need to do this. And in the December of 1997, we opened a pagan community center in Deep Ellum in Dallas, Texas. And it was quite an eye-opening experience.
And you're talking about Betwixt and Between. And you and I, our paths have overlapped many, many times for many, many years. But that's where it fell short, I think, because I just had moved away from Dallas when Betwixt and Between opened. So please tell us about that with Betwixt and Between. What were you experiencing?
Well, Betwixt and Between started in a small little building on Bryan Street in off of Live Oak in the Deep Ellum area of Dallas. It was wonderful. You know, people came at night. There was nowhere, let's say you wanted to read a poem about a god or some experience you had in your faith in paganism or any pagan-like faith, because we were open to all faiths, alternative faiths, well, any faith. But you couldn't go somewhere else to do that. So people would gather on the weekends, come there, and we got going. We were doing really well. There were a lot of people coming to visit. We were getting media attention. And I remember a minister showing up on a Friday night, and it was sort of like going to a nightclub in a way. You know, we were doing live music and different things. People were celebrating their faith through faith-based things. And this minister showed up, and he had asked me if I might. If he walked around and talked to people, he really wanted to share with them about his church. And I said, I'm absolutely down with that. If you would just first, before you get started, give me the name of your church and where it's located. And he said, well, I don't understand. I said, well, I'll come Sunday and do the same thing at your place. He left.
Of course he did.
We did, and then people for quite a while were very certain that they were going to, you know, burn crosses outside our door, which there was occasion in Dallas at that time that anywhere you went, if you were in Deep Ellum walking around at night, which is a lot like being in the French Quarter or any celebratory evening place in a city, you know, that's marked off for that. Well, they would be dragging their cross and have a Christ-like character pulling along a cross with blood and thorn and all that stuff. And so at any moment I was anticipating somebody, because I you know, people had things to say about it. And one day our building faced the east, and it was like the coming of God out the front door every morning as the sun rose. And this woman and man walked in, and she had on her habit and her long dark robes. And as they came out of the sun, I realized it was a man in a long trench coat and a woman who had her hair pulled back, and she had long black hair and was wearing black with a white turtleneck under it. And it wasn't, they were artists down the street, but I was certain they had come. But
oh, that's funny.
So we very quickly experienced our own discrimination there, though. And this is the kind of discrimination I want to talk about, that subtle way that it ebbs into your life or kind of poisons the well water, so to say. We, our landlord really, really liked us up until that point, but he had other partners and had some other properties. And we had a really nice article written in the Dallas Morning News about us, about our program, Bohemian Dreams, which was an open mic night. And it was so well written and so wonderful. It had been written by our treasurer, Jesse Owens, that they you know, he came over and told us we had to get out. He evicted us without the proper procedure, without doing anything. And when we refused that we were just going to leave like that, that we, you know, we needed him to file, you know, charges and stuff to make it fair.
Right.
He took an axe and he told us he was going to get in and get our computers and the names of the people that had joined our membership, and took an axe to the phone lines of our building.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So then we couldn't leave the building, because the one thing I promised everybody who was terrified of losing their jobs by being members of this nonprofit, that we stayed in the building. So the board and several people, lots of people stayed for days. It was a stinky sit-in. I'm just going to say that.
Oh, but I imagine.
We stayed and ended up then an attorney friend ended up coming to Dallas and, you know, helped us with the police. The police ended up arresting him for harassing us. I think he tried to take an axe to our electric. I know there was something where he tried to cut our electricity off and he broke some walls, but we ended up having to move. It did make all the news, and it just began to be an outpouring from there. I had members who lived in smaller communities, like a community up. I can't remember the name, to be honest, Melissa, but I think it was Quinlan, just out there by, McKinney.
And that sounds about right. That sounds accurate.
These two young women, they came to Betwixt and found me and told me they had crosses burned in their front lawn, and they did.
Oh my God. And
I have seen quite a few horrific things happen to people. Now, I don't think those things happen now, but back then it was still kind of fair game to prey upon people of alternative faiths.
I tend to think they probably are still happening in small numbers or quiet numbers in smaller towns, when someone is either revealed to be a member of the pagan, you know, walk of life, whether that's they're a Wiccan or they're a Buddhist or, you know, they're a Satanist or whatever. But also, just like it happened in the 1600s, just being accused and just being thought of being weird or different. So I imagine there are probably still crosses being burned on properties of people trying to, that's the persecution part, people trying to, you know, persecute and bring out into the open someone that's walking a quiet faith.
Well, the good thing is the pagan community is not a quiet lot. And so when things like that happen, we do tend to know about it. I will say, since the years that I actively was doing the religious discrimination, we had an entire team, and we worked on a national level quite often to fight discrimination for folks. We had attorneys to help and things. When we stopped, I found that the Wild Hunt, the news organization we have that puts out articles and things, the Wild Hunt picks that up. So a lot of times people will report those things, and things have gotten a lot better. I am certain, though, that subtle discrimination happens all the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think so, too. And, you know, so I've got a little story I'm going to tell. It's not about me. As I mentioned a moment ago, I've been pretty fortunate to not have encountered very much or any persecution or discrimination based on my being a witch. But my best friend, who you know who this is, I'm going to call her Lucy for the sake of her anonymity, she was having to fight with her ex-husband in court for custody of their two daughters, who wanted to stay with their mom, by the way. She was at the time a practitioner of Wicca. I think Gardnerian Wicca was probably exactly what she was practicing. And she kept, I have to say, a ridiculously well-organized Book of Shadows is really a Wiccan term, I think. So her Book of Shadows was a thing of beauty. So in court, her ex-husband's attorney presented as evidence several pages of Lucy's Book of Shadows that he had torn out without her knowledge, clearly without her knowledge, and no regard for any of the sacred spirituality of this book of hers, of her Book of Shadows. And then his attorney weaponized the Wiccan reed against her and leveled all kinds of accusations about witchcraft, and really tried their very best to destroy my friend's credibility. And my friend always referred to her ex-husband's attorney as a shark. She was good at what she did, you know, but she, Lucy knew beforehand that if she had gone into court and said, you know, I'm a witch or I practice Wicca or witchcraft or whatever, that her goose would have been pretty well cooked. You know what I mean by saying that. So she just sort of decided to keep her mouth shut and to, as we say, to keep silent. I don't think she was really that worried about the witchcraft angle, though. And, you know, and she had her plan kind of like cemented in place to keep mum about everything. Then in court, when her ex's attorney said to her, "So I hear you're into witchcraft." I mean, she, of course, she feigned ignorance at the time. And she said, "Well, I'm a spiritual seeker. Excuse me. I'm a spiritual seeker. I don't know what you're talking about," you know, and figured she was pretty well covered. But what that actually did in reality was to create the perfect setup for that shark divorce attorney to level an attack. So the attorney opened up a file, you know, as they do, presenting something in evidence that only Lucy could see the pages of. And she saw that they were pages of her Book of Shadows. She was completely flustered, obviously, and that was the desired effect from that attorney. And she was shocked, and she didn't really know, you know, really where to go with that. Then the attorney started to speak in what she described as kind of smarmy, a mockingly witchy tone, reading from the papers that were taken out of her Book of Shadows. And for the sake of the court, she said, "Bide ye the Wiccan reed ye must, in perfect love and perfect trust." Just really evil and horrible and ugly. And so Lucy, I said, "How did that make you feel?" And she said, "I felt so violated." Because it suddenly hit her that her husband had stolen pages of her Book of Shadows like 7 years prior to their custody hearing and divorce. And he'd been plotting to use that against her all along. So she felt completely persecuted. The happy ending of the story, though, is that she actually did win custody of her daughters in the end. The judge tossed all that out. So he said it was really not germane, not important to this. But so she did get custody, but not without a fight. And, you know, and an attempt by her ex-husband and his attorney to persecute her for being a witch, for practicing Wicca. I mean, I was her friend when that was going on, and she like lost all this weight because she was always sick. She was terrified she was going to lose her daughters. You know, that is modern day witch hunt persecution in my estimation.
And that still happens to this day. And that is a whole other kind of show. I'm not saying that isn't pertinent here, but we could do a whole show just on how, you know, people, well, I know why I brought this show up to you is that I personally have witnessed a bit of how someone can take something and turn it to their advantage by playing the witch card. I want to share with you a story that happened because not only when I started Betwixt and Between, I had become a representative for WADL, which is the Witches Anti-Discrimination League. I was a Texas state rep, along with Patricia Snodgrass, by the way. That's how I met her.
And well, she's my friend, too.
I saw that. And then also AREN was another organization. And Betwixt and Between's civil rights division was being born, and we had a young couple who were giving birth to their first child at the St. Paul Hospital in Dallas. Now, since then, St. Paul has modernized their systems of how they do things, but this young woman checked in and put Wicca on. She was in labor and put Wicca on her religion. Mm-hmm. And before that baby was born, they had taken that child away from her.
Oh my God.
That friend at the hospital had a friend who was in CPS who went outside of what she was legally allowed to do. And they lost everything in their apartment. We went in and helped them fight. We helped them get into somewhere. You know, we did a lot of, when people would lose their jobs, we would support them and things in other ways besides trying to show up. And, you know, it became quite interesting. The more we were around, the more people became afraid. And so we started seeing discrimination on so many different levels. We got very practiced in the art of standing up to people. But Texas, as you know, is a right to work state. And so businesses have a right to fire you for whatever reason. This means that if they decide that they think if someone looks at you and doesn't like that candle and that stone on your desk, and I'm going to tell you folks, if you're listening to this and you've come accustomed to having stones and candles and little things like that on your desk, 20 years ago, that would have been a different story. And so in Texas, that would have been enough in many places. You know, we're all in the Bible Belt. We're all in the buckle of the Bible Belt. Yeah, I hear that all the time. That people would get fired for those things. I would have people come and collapse in my arms at Betwixt and Between because they had been fired because someone thought someone had done a spell. And it reminded me so much of Salem and the way those young girls were just angry, mean little girls, you know, who said all those things and caused such fear. And, you know, this happened to this young woman and family, and we were able to get there. It took us about 6 weeks, and they were finally able to have their child.
Well, okay. So first of all, my first reaction to that is thanks, Maven, because your mothering, and your mothering caused you to spread those wings and protect somebody and help them get their child back. And my second reaction is, I mean, like holy fuck, that is terrifying.
Well, and since then, what has happened is, like, whatever city I've lived in, and I know there's several other people, I've done prison ministries, there's lots of people who do prison ministries now. And there are people who have have the right to be chaplain at the hospital. While I was in Dallas-Fort Worth with Betwixt and Between, I served at hospitals. Hospitals called me all the time and said they had someone in there that needed, spiritual counsel and stuff. I came for that. It became, because of Betwixt and Between's presence with a threshold, we had some things that happened for us that by being there, it one allowed us to become part of Dallas's Council of Faith. They had a Dallas coalition of churches that, because we had a threshold, we were welcomed in. We had attended in Betwixt's early days. We had attended a thing at a university where they had different faiths come in to the kids coming in and let them have all these different representatives about spiritual life. And while there, our information officer met the local head of the Baptist, the Southern Baptist group there in Dallas that ran everything, that a big, beautiful church, by the way. And he invited us to participate at Thanksgiving Square, which is the oldest interfaith organization in the world. And so we got to participate with them. Because we got to participate with them, then I was invited to be on the Dallas Independent School District Religious Task Force, where I got to come to meetings with all the other faces of faith in the city. And that didn't go over real well in the beginning. I'm going to say that there was some real push about us being there. And that led to opening doors, though, because then Dallas, we didn't know, was the school that the National Education Department, they used their calendar as a calendar of acceptance across the country. So when we were able to get our Wiccan or pagan holidays on the calendar, and then for them to be excused, for teachers who could take it off if it was Beltane or Samhain, or they had somewhere to go. If you wanted to go to CMA and celebrate the season, that spiritual religious experience, you could take that off without any recourse, and students too. And those calendar days became part of the national education, the patent that they use for acceptable holidays. So it became like ripples in a pond. And from there, we were invited to be in the faith-based initiative with George Bush's when he first came out with that. And that helped me because back in the day, you weren't allowed. It was in the law that you couldn't wear pentacles or any of that kind of religious attire to school. So I don't know if you remember that, but that's like all I did with my life for years was all these schools were kicking kids out and we'd go meet with the school board and stand up for the kids and get them back in school. And Canada's organization, religioustolerance.org, started backing me up and helping me and writing letters on my behalf. And I had some different reporters with the AP and different groups that would also support and help us. And when I got on the faith-based initiative, I went to an event in Austin where every head of every department in the United States government attended that meeting. And in a break, we were all out. I can't remember the name of the hotel, but it's downtown Austin. It was Schwank.
So Schwank.
And I just had my hair colored. It was not like, it was like eggplant reddish purple kind of color, which I never do that, so it was really weird for me. And I met every one of them, and in a sit down with like seven or eight, explained to them what we experienced, as far as especially speaking to the head of the education department, what we experienced. And they went back and changed the law. That's why you never hear kids getting kicked out of school anymore. That day, that one being allowed to be at the table, because betwixt and between had a threshold. That's the only way we got to be there, without having an address. That's why I'm still such an advocate for community-based organizations.
So that would have been, excuse me, that would have been in 1990 something?
That was probably
or the early aughts.
It was the early aughts.
Okay. Let me just throw out there when you said, do you remember that? Because I do remember that. But I also, like my beginnings as a witch happened my senior year in high school. So we're talking about the 1980s. I'm not going to give a year on that. But I was so closeted because I was in so much fear for of my family finding out. But I was so closeted. I didn't even tell my best friend in high school that I was learning about, and I was reading, and I was considering, and I was really getting involved with witchcraft. There was a weird girl at our school, and I say that in the nicest way possible because I consider myself a weird girl. There was a weird girl in my school my junior year. She was a senior, and she did get sent home because she was wearing what they called satanic jewelry, and it was a pinnacle. It was an upright pinnacle. So I do remember that happening, but that also sort of put the so-called fear of God in me to not do anything like that my senior year. But mainly it was because if the school saw it, my parents would find out, and then, oh my gosh, everything would end. So yeah, thank you for doing that, Maven.
Well, I would like to talk about West Memphis 3 since we've kind of got to that place, in my opinion, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. And let me tell you, anybody that knew me before the West Memphis 3 were released on the Alford plea, they're not exonerated. They're free, but they're not exonerated. Anybody that knew me prior to that knew if I started talking about it, I wouldn't stop. So let's talk about the West Memphis 3. If you're not familiar with that, I will list links on the description for this episode about who the West Memphis 3 are and why we fought so hard for their release from prison. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Maven.
Well, I often talk about Never Again the Burning Times is really, it's nothing more than a mantra if we don't defend it by deed. And I, just as I was opening betwixt and between, I was sitting on a couch at my sister's house, and my 16-year-old son, who had his hair dark and was wearing a Metallica shirt, was on one side of me, and in my lap, curled up, sleeping with his head in my lap, was my 8-year-old son, as I sat down to watch the documentary of the West Memphis 3. And if for the listeners out there, the West Memphis 3 is the story of six young boys. Three young boys were murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas. And upon seeing the brutalized bodies, a probation officer on the scene, it being the biggest crime that had ever happened there, had one of the other boys was on probation. He got busted with a little pot, if I remember correctly. And that boy had told him he was studying Wicca. And in that moment, he decided, they all decided who did that. Now, even though Damien Eccles, who was a couple years older than the other two boys involved, so there were 3 8-year-old boys and 18 and a couple 16, maybe 15 year olds. And they decided that just because Damien was interested in Wicca, that made him this satanic murderer. But Damien was even in school that day. At the time of the incident, those kids, they were, there was roll call and they were where they were supposed to be, and nobody cared. So here I sit with one child sitting next to me that reminded me of the boys being persecuted. And here are these three little boys who were brutally murdered. And it was horrific. There is no doubt there was a town terrified by this experience. And when that came out, I recognized that that all tied into part of, like I said, I had this calling. Well, this all came together as Betwixt was opening. And about a year after the first video was released, we were contacted as a place with a door to host a fundraiser by HBO. It's called Paradise Lost. Then they came and they filmed a second documentary, part of the documentary at Betwixt and Between Community Center. And Dream Tribe / Velvet Hammer, I know you had Linda and Ginger on recently. They were, you know, they were there. Their part didn't go in the film, but it was quite a nice, interesting meeting for everybody. But anyway, we continued on and did fundraisers and brought awareness. And the, like you said, they did eventually get out, but they were never exonerated. They were...
Right.
And even though there is every bit of evidence that they did not do it. So this again is the satanic panic we knew in the 90s. But that's also, paganism has been the fastest growing religion since the late 90s. And that really chips away at other religions' coffers.
I'm going to contribute something about the West Memphis Three really quickly. And I mentioned they were... released from prison on something called an Alford plea. Mm-hmm. An Alford plea, if anyone listening does not know what that is in the United States government and judicial system, an Alford plea happens when the state is unable to sustain a retrial because they don't have enough evidence. So, and that's exactly what happened. They were the state was facing another whole trial for Jesse Miss Kelly and Jason Baldwin and Damien Eccles, the three, the West Memphis Three, as they're known. And they had a really good crack team of attorneys this go around that were really on the ball. And there was absolutely no doubt in anybody's mind, including the state of Arkansas, that they could win the trial against those three gentlemen who were now adults and had been in prison for, was it 18 years, maybe?
Yes,
is that right?
It was 18.
Okay. And they went in as like 18 and 16 year olds.
Oh, yeah.
And they totally missed the whole like information era that cropped up with the internet and phones. And I mean, like, can you imagine not knowing how to do that? And they didn't, because they weren't afforded that freedom. So the state of Arkansas says, well, I'm guessing, you know, we ain't gonna win this one, gentlemen. So let's do what people do when they don't have another card left. Give them the Alford plea. And what the Alford plea, and let them take that if they want to. What the Alford plea is Damien Eccles and Jesse Miss Kelly and Jason Baldwin had to say, okay, I'm guilty, so that you'll let me out of prison.
Yes, they had to admit guilt to get out.
And they're able to say their own words and say, you know, I am absolutely not guilty in any way whatsoever. And the evidence against me could not be held up in court because it doesn't exist. But I'll say I'm guilty if you'll let me go free. And so they all did that. Jason Baldwin wasn't going to, because he stood by everything he said, and I didn't do this. Why would I say I did it? But he understood that if he didn't do that also, Damien Eccles, who of the three gentlemen that were in prison, was the only one on death row, and he had run out of appeals, I think, if I'm correct about this. And so Jason Baldwin let his conscience be his guide and said, I want my friend out of prison, and also out from underneath, you know, the noose. So they all three are out of prison, but they are not exonerated. And that is
Jason Baldwin. He was a very special young man. He really had a bright mind. He wrote us, the treasurer at the time, Jesse Owens, who was part of the team that we really worked on this West Memphis 3 thing. He would write Jesse because Jesse was an archaeologist and he was really trying to find something outside of his prison life. And it wasn't a lot. I don't want to say they form like great relationship, but you know, I remember in the video when you talk about Jesse Miss Kelly, when that is probably the hardest part still to me, when they interviewed him in this, and I get choked up when I mean, like, I'm trying not to do that because we're on the air here, but when he said, I just got to get more used to it. I just got to get more used to it. You know, Jesse Miss Kelly's he was not as wise in the ways of the world as the other boys. His understanding of what was happening to him was not as acute. And I, as kindly as I can say that, but just witnessing what they went through and seeing all of this lets me know what's possible. So I want to share with you that just because we were in this film, before it aired, I started receiving death threats. And
I mean, I want to say I'm surprised by that, but you know, I'm honestly not surprised by that. I'm disgusted by it, but I'm not completely surprised.
Well, back in that time, we didn't have YouTube. We didn't have Yahoo groups or anything like that. We had just barely started having BBC boards where people could all be on one website and talk to one another. And in that time, we were discussing this when a gentleman, as a pagan group of people, I think we were on Denal's board at the time. And a gentleman called Refrigerator Bill came on and told me that if the guys ever got out of jail, he was going to kill them and send them to me in body bags with bombs in them. And that got a whole bunch of, you know, attraction from law enforcement and different things. It's also how Walter Five and I come into meeting each other, is that Walter was on that list and said, you know what, I'm here and I work for the federal government and I see what you're doing. And I'm, you know, he like stepped up and kind of protected me. But at that time, West Memphis, the town of West Memphis, when the second documentary came out, they had a list of most wanted. It was on their city charter page, whatever. And I became the second most wanted person, only under Damien Eccles. The other two boys were below me. I was not allowed to stop in that town or be found in the city limits without fear of going to jail.
That's terrifying. That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, I don't know if that ever changed, because that was real serious. They were damn serious about it.
I want to real quick also honor the memory of the three little boys that were murdered. Stevie Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore. And those little boys were innocent little kids, and some monster murdered them. And I have my suspicions, but those suspicions absolutely did not ever include the gentlemen that are known as the West Memphis Three. I just wanted to say their names and give them the ability to rest in power. They never had a say in anything.
They did.
And I can say also that the parent, the single parent of Stevie Branch, has come to understand that there's absolutely no way that Damien Eccles, Jesse Miss Kelly, or Jason Baldwin murdered her child. And then another one of the parents, another set of the parents, won't speak to media at all. So, and I can't really blame them. They lost their child.
I think it's come down to that they believe it's one of the stepfathers of the, out of the three sets of parents. It looks
Stevie Branch's,
Stevie Branch's stepdad. I know that when the when Bruce and Joe were with us doing the filming, they had ghastly stories of when they were there and the odd things people said and people giving them knives, and just it was very terrifying. The whole city was caught up in satanic panic. So,
yeah. It's important to me to speak their names because the whole thing surrounding the West Memphis Three is because of the murders of these three boys, but their names, I don't want their names to be lost in history. So
I agree with you.
So if they can ever prove Terry Hobbs did it, because I certainly believe he did. And there's evidence that puts him at the scene of the crime.
But here,
there was no such evidence for the three men who spent 18 years in prison.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Where's the passion to get him now? Where's that passion that locked those boys away without any evidence they'd even been there? Where was the passion?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a stretch for me to say that West Memphis, Arkansas, which is just over the bridge from Memphis, Tennessee, West Memphis, Arkansas is not a very moneyed community. There's a lot of middle class and there's a fair amount of poverty. And even though Stevie Branch's family was on the, probably at the time, the closer to the bottom end of the middle class, they were still in the middle class. I mean, their phone had been cut off. They didn't have a phone to call 911 when Stevie went missing. But the three guys that were arrested with no evidence and sentenced to prison, and one of them to the death, had the death penalty. Those three young men also came from West Memphis, Arkansas, and they were on the low end of the poverty side, specifically Jesse Miss Kelly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I think that it's a town that is probably still run by the Good Old Boy Network. And Terry Hobbs used to play basketball or football or whatever with somebody on the police department, upper echelon. So, I mean, that's a theory. But that can actually be traced back to, yeah, they went to high school together. They're good friends, you know, and you just got to know one person. You know what, Maven, you and I have both worked in that industry. We understand how the Good Old Boy Network can work.
Oh, it does indeed. And I do remember also that prior to this event happening, that Damien could not leave the house, that he wasn't picked up or harassed or, you know, couldn't. And such a smart young man. And what amazing work he's doing these days.
He's incredible, and I follow him on Twitter, and I would absolutely love, I mean, I listen, if I spent 18 years in prison on death row, I probably wouldn't want to talk about it real often, but if Damien, if you're listening, I'd love to speak to you about this, but I would absolutely love to have another all West Memphis 3 podcast, because it is related to witchcraft, because it is about witchcraft persecution, regardless of anybody's spiritual proclivities at the time of those murders. It didn't matter. We're in the 21st century, and you don't go to prison for being a witch anymore.
You really don't, but you
can, you know, and that could have happened to anybody that I know.
I think that, you know, not to put too much of a political slant on this, but I think that was some of the greater fears, you know, a little over 8 years ago, that when there was a change in administration, there was fear that those things could rise again, because we saw such politicizing of faith that it was frightening. I do rest and breathe a little easier these days.
Yeah, they tended to weaponize Christianity towards anybody that wasn't Christian or even Christian enough. So, you know, when I say things like vote like your life depends on it, it's because my life could depend on it. Your life could. The person who I'm speaking to, their life could depend on it. So that's it remains a fact that not being Christian in America might not be against the law, but it's sure against the law of public opinion.
We don't see any outwardly public pagan officials in our country.
Thank the universe. We've just started to see transgender public officials in our country, and people of color, and you know, people of color, and also LGBTQIA members are now becoming representatives to the people. And that's the way it should be. And I would love to get openly atheist, openly pagan, openly witchcraft practicing individuals also on that roster at some point in my life, you know, in my lifetime. I'd love to see that in my lifetime.
Yeah. And if people, when you know, if you are coming new to Wicca, witchcraft, paganism, however you find this, there's a variety of ways you might define yourself, and it's all okay. But as you come to this, I want you to remember that witchcraft, the word witch, comes from the root word witta, which means wise one, that much of our European ancestry when they were tribes were quite often, most often, matriarchally based because they were hunters and gatherers. The wise woman stayed behind. She took care of the, you know, the small little tribe. If you can imagine 30 of you out camping somewhere and you have your little huts and you have your group and your, you know, the men went off, they hunted, the women stayed behind and took care of things, managed things. You can remember that as first peoples, we too are tribal people. We may no longer live in the countries of our origin, but nonetheless, I promise you that I and all of us who come from Europe have a connection to those grandmothers who were there still eking out a living as wild people. Without shame, I'm as proud of my wild tribal ancestry as any other people on this planet, and I will not be shamed for my faith. And that's who we began as. As the world turns, you know, one group goes to a place and things change. You know, look, we came when America was colonized, the first people here were really put in a disadvantage. Well, the same thing happened in Europe. Another group of people came and colonized, and that changed things. But that doesn't take away the beauty of our ancestry or the rights to respect and honor and live into that and to long to know what they believed. And we have a right not to be shamed. Each and every one of you have a right not to be shamed. But we also have to do our part.
Well, I want to thank my guest today, who's, I mean, like, it's weird to call you a guest. You're such a dear friend of mine. But I want to thank you, Maven LR5, for joining me today. And it was a very enlightening and eye-opening conversation. You can find Maven at mysticelements.com if you want to schedule a reading for her. Are you still doing readings over online?
I am. I am part of it, actually.
And you can do them on the phone as well if someone is not in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, perfect. You can also find her on Facebook at Maven's Magical Life, all one word, and spell your magic like we witches do with a K instead of just a C. Maven, M-A-E-V-E-N-S, M-A-G-I-C-K-A-L-L-I-F-E on Facebook. Thank you, Maven.
Is that the name of somebody who's a big ol' Leo or what?
I also want to mention that if you or anyone else you know or love is experiencing religious discrimination or persecution of any kind, you can reach out to the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, at aclu.org. There's a brand new episode every Wednesday. And as always, if you have questions or comments about this or any other episode of this podcast, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Wear your goddamn fucking mask. May you never hunger and may you never thirst. As above, so below. Remember, voter suppression is real and it's happening all across the country. Register to vote if you're not already. Check your registration status and check it often, and then vote like your life depends on it. Like I said, every election, every time. Thanks for listening. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe. I'm Molly Dyer. This is Witchcraft Off the Beaten Path.